asking if Nintendo was right in keeping Lost Levels away from the NES, the unpredictable rise of speedrunning, what your favorite Mario character says about you, and questioning the truth of the familiar claim that Super Mario Bros. 2 is just a reskin. I'm the Well-Read Mage, and this is MageCast X. Not one, not two, not even three games take center stage on this episode. Four games do. Returning guest Joe Bory, a.k.a. Cinco Play, author, collector, and developer, helps us sort out the differences between Super Mario Bros. 2 USA, Super Mario Bros. 2 Japan, The Lost Levels, and Doki Doki Panic. This is a second-parter episode that really should be enjoyed after listening to the previous regarding the Famicom. But if you're ready to dive into Mario Mania anyway, then all I can say is, yeah, wahoo, let's-a-go! In a gaming world full of shouting, mudslinging, gaslighting, and screaming into the void, MageCast X is the podcast for conversationalists. Learn more at thepixels.com, that's the-pixels.com. You can support the show by visiting patreon.com/thepixels. We greatly appreciate every listen, every rating, and review. And now, let's summon the show. Hello, my friends. Welcome to the second part of our two-parter episode series here. Actually, this episode is just a reskin of the first episode, episode 95, which was about the Famicom, in case you missed it. That was joke, boy. I keep throwing them, but they fly over that little blue bonnet of yours. This is just the second half of a discussion on the Famicom that, well, it was beefy, let's say. It was very meaty. So what we decided to do was to put off our main topic, which was to be Doki Doki Panic, and save that for its own episode. And voila, here it is. So I hope that you enjoy it today, but let's go ahead and introduce the folk who are joining me. My friend Criterion Jared is here with me as co-host. How's it going, Crit?
Mr. Mage, I'm doing quite all right. How are you doing on this wonderful, wonderful morning so far?
Yeah, it's an Aloha Friday. I'm feeling it. Today is actually it's my cat's birthday, Gandalf.
Turned. Happy birthday, Gandalf.
Yes, he's. Thanks for pronouncing it correctly as well. You know, everybody knows I'm all about correct pronunciations.
Oh, absolutely. Right, I already screwed that up earlier. I'm gonna try. Should we even talk? No. Well, no, let's proceed to the episode first. Yeah. But let's just say there was a mispronunciation on my own part.
No. Hey,
has
you
been
know what?
Corrected.
But you're cool, so you can pronounce it however you want to. That's the rule. But yeah, today Gandalf the Grey is 11 years old, human years, and 60, I think it is, in cat years, and he didn't look a day over 56. So we're gonna have a little party tonight, for him and. I don't know, maybe
a
get like a little
cat birthday party sounds like everything I would want to do right now.
I know,
I'm actually a little
right?
bit envious.
Basically, just lie on the floor. that's it. So my kids were super excited this morning. They wake up and my son's like, "Are we still going to school? Because it's the cat's birthday."
It's a cat's birthday. No, that's actually me.
Let me call your teachers. Me. My son won't be to school today because it's my cat's birthday. Yeah, that would have been a fun conversation. Anyway,
cat called the school. Sorry. Anyway,
right.
Please.
No, yeah. We'll just talk about cats the whole time. Speaking of cats, Joe. Joe is back, a.k.a. Syncoplay. How's that for an introduction? Joe,
I'll take it.
Hell, he'll take it. Joe Bory, Syncoplay, you may know him as on the socials, but he was with us for our discussion of Famicom. He's here representing the Famicom as a Famicom expert, writing a book on Famicom in case you hadn't heard yet. And you do need to check out the links in the podcast description. So Joe, man, let's do a little second intro. You know, just in case somebody hasn't listened to the previous episode, but just tell us a little snippet of yourself, a little flavor of Joe, and then we'll talk about your book a bit.
All right. Yeah. So apparently I'm part cat. So this is news to me. So I've got my background is in video game design and development. So I've been doing game design for, I don't know, since the year the Xbox 360 was released, whatever year that was. Worked on a number of consoles, PC, Facebook, mobile, just kind of ran the gamut all the way up to location-based virtual reality. And somewhere along that line, I got super interested in doing retro gaming stuff. And so started up Single Play Retro Gaming, which is all about kind of making your game room look cool through display stands and signage and all of that. And got super, super interested in Famicom during my game collection. So the book that I'm working on is Beyond the NES, which is a deep dive into just everything cool about the Famicom, the games that we never saw in the West, and kind of the interesting things that we can glean from playing these games that are, you know, they're very old, but they're new to us.
Mm-hmm. That is a unique experience, too. When it's a favorite system, especially. And I've got to have that experience recently trying to play through all of the RPGs on the Super Nintendo and coming across one that's new to me. That's wonderful. But now you're unlocking games that are new to almost everybody in North America. A whole ton of them. And love that title too, by the way. What are some of the other titles that you might have gone with on that one?
Oh boy. I did. It's been a while. So what ended up happening was I ended up coming up with a whole list of potential titles and then getting titles from other people and sort of making a spreadsheet that mishmashed, you know, there's like, it could do like, use the word Beyond, or I could call it the NES, or I could call it Famicom, and just basically mishmashed a whole bunch of stuff together and picked out the best. So to be honest, Beyond the NES is one of the few that really stuck out to me during that process. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I did not prepare an answer for that one.
No, it's all good. I expect you to remember every title that you possibly came up with.
I've kind of locked in at this point.
It makes sense. It's nice. I think it's a simple title that conveys exactly the concept of the book. You're also not the first person. So like you gave me the immense privilege of being able to see some of these titles when you're putting it together, which was really fun. And I've spoken with a couple other people that are interested in book writing and, you know, are in the process of it. And some of the titles that folk come up with, I'm like, this is the title itself is an encyclopedia. You kind of have to have, you know, some concision. Is that the right word?
Well, that was kind of the case with some of the ones in that sheet. And as you know, if I remember right, I think you're the one that ended up suggesting Beyond the NES first as the potential title, but the I still did put a subtitle in there, which is Rediscovering 8-bit on the Japanese Famicom. But the reason for that is I want Famicom to be on the cover so people know what the heck the book is about. But I agree with you, having a nice concise 3-word Beyond the NES, I think helps people just understand in a nutshell what this book is without being encyclopedic.
Right. Yeah. And no, like you can have a little more freedom, I think, with a subtitle to kind of have it be a little more wordy. But imagine if that all of that, like the subtitle plus your main title, was just the title, that your entire cover would be just words. I don't remember which one I thought was best. If you said it was the Beyond the NES, I believe you.
I think it was. Well, I'm going to give you credit for that. I want to give you the credit.
I want to accept the credit. I honestly don't remember, but I do remember the selection title process was really fun. So let's to talk a little bit more about the book. There is a free sample that's available right now. And again, folks, look at the podcast description. There's a link there. Go and check it out. Download the sample. It's awesome.
Please do it. I'm begging you.
It's begging. Such a good sample too.
I'm on my knees.
I'm begging.
I've never recorded a podcast on my knees, but here I am.
Here we are. It's yeah. absolutely
the
worth
penitent
it.
Man. Shall
you might want to sit down. It'll be more comfortable.
Okay. Yeah. 2 hours yeah. on my knees. Like, so you've taken a lot of inspiration from retro magazines. What are some of your favorite magazines?
Oh my gosh. As I mentioned in the last podcast, I was the kid who my parents would be grocery shopping and I would be in the magazine aisle just pouring through EGM, GamePro, Nintendo Power, and just basically memorizing and living vicariously through everything I saw in those magazines. I also mentioned if I would get money for Christmas or something, I would spend it on subscriptions. So I had a subscription through most of my childhood to Nintendo Power, to GamePro, and to EGM. And those were kind of like my three core ones, as I say, pre-high school. I could effectively, for the cost of a single game, get a year's subscription to all three of those magazines. And in my head, play through, you know, hundreds of games, sort of. Mm-hmm. Once I got into high school, my actual favorite gaming magazine hit, which was Next Generation. But that kind of speaks to the game developer in me. Next Generation dove a lot deeper into the actual games industry and topics like, you know, the trials in which this started the ESRB rating system, and deep development interviews with people like John Carmack, who had done the technology behind Doom and Quake. And so that became something I could really deep dive into and nerd out once I started getting into game development myself. But beyond the NES, because most of these games were never even reported in those old magazines, I've started diving into kind of the Japanese side of gaming magazines. So Famitsu, of course, is the one that most people think of when they think of Japanese magazines, but right. there were quite a few popular ones. And one of my favorites recently has been Famicom Hishoban magazine, which is the Famicom Victory Book, I think is the best way to anglicize it. It's just a fun magazine that they had like one cartoonist who would do all these kind of fun, like comics and stuff throughout the magazine. And so it feels just kind of has its own personality and its own unique nature. And I know Famitsu did that as well, but like Famicom Hishoban, I just find that style to be, endearing.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. And Famitsu magazine, every time it's brought up to me, like in my mind, that's kind of like, that's the final boss of magazines. Well, they've been around. I just looked up 1986 through present is a ridiculous amount of time for a single magazine.
And it was weekly.
Yeah.
Weekly. That's shocking to me.
That's a ton of magazines in that period of time. You know, that's my entire lifetime of just a magazine every single week. And like, what you think, like since then, other magazines have come and gone, like Nintendo Power has come and gone. Mad Magazine has come and gone. Famitsu, though, yeah, the final boss of magazines here.
Oh, I'm certainly not going to be reading through the entire library of Famitsu, but I've been picking and choosing from kind of the 1986 to 1994 range, because that's when kind of Famicom had its peak. So
yeah. And that makes sense, obviously. Yeah, there's no point for you to, for the sake of this book at least, you know, check out the ones around the year 2000. What have been some of your favorite games to write about so far? I get that this is a kind of a spoilery question. You may be admitting, you know, the inclusion of certain games in the book. I don't know if you're comfortable with that, but favorite games to write about so far in your book.
Look, I already expect that by the time this is all done with, I will have spoiled over 20% of the book on social media, okay. And I'm totally cool with that. Okay. Now, so you know, the sample book contains, you know, a few of my absolute favorites. I had a blast doing the one pager on King Kong 2. And part of the reason for that is that I was sort of channeling my diehard game fan / when EGM let their hair down type review style for that. So okay. It's full of ridiculous puns.
Nice.
It also contains one for Insector X, where I actually took a scan from an advertisement in a Japanese magazine, retooled the scan to be a review page for Insector X, and of course filled it with bug puns because, again, it's
fun. How could
fun.
You not at that point? It's low-hanging fruit.
But it's, I think, in general, my favorite ones to do are those ones in which I take a classic game magazine scan and repurpose it somehow. And so, you know, it's, I can't obviously do that with every single game in the book because I'll be working on this book until, you know, 2050. But for select games, I love to like pick out, like find an ad in this in the magazine, Photoshop out all of the Japanese stuff, put in kind of the English versions of it, update some of the screenshots and so on. And I've got a really fun one that I've been working on for a little while for a game called Pokun Magura, which is whack-a-mole. The funny thing about this whack-a-mole game is it actually came in a big box with its own whack-a-mole mat and a rubber mallet. And it's basically the same technology as the power pad, just made miniature. And so you actually play the game on the TV with this peripheral. And, you know, it's a simple game, but it's cute, it's fun. And the art on the box and everything was really chaotic and wacky. So sort of channeling that wacky art style into a review page has been a ton of fun.
That's awesome. It's cool to dig up stuff like that. So I hadn't heard of this one, looking at pictures of it just now. I think of a DDR pad when I look at this. That's fantastic. Incredible. So you can see the kind of work, you know, that Joe's putting into this book. I think it's going to surprise a lot of people, certainly educate a lot of people. Speaking of education, now, educate us a bit on some of your favorite developers for the Famicom.
I'm not only going to say favorite developer, but favorite year for that developer.
Oh,
1987 Konami. Now, I mean, there are a few of these sort of bleed into December 1986, but 1987 Konami gave us Gradius, gave us Contra, gave us Getsu Fumiden, gave us, actually Gradius was 86, but close enough. gave us Goemon, King Kong 2. Sorry, I'm just looking at my shelf over here, picking out all of the amazing stuff that Konami did. Metal Gear, right? Mm-hmm. Konami was absolutely on fire in late 86 through 87. And like, this is the reason why they founded the Ultra label in the US, is because like Nintendo had this rule that you could only publish 5 games. But if you look at Konami's output in 1987, how do you choose only 5?
Yeah.
And then, I mean, that's not even counting when you start looking at Disk System and getting stuff like Armada no Kiseki, which is a fantastic game that, one of the most unique platformers in the Disk System era. So yeah, anyway, 87 Konami, absolutely fantastic. Outside of that, right, I mean, there were definitely a lot of publishers that did like consistently great stuff. We know Capcom, right? And they did a lot of really good stuff. I mean, Namco, they were hit and miss, but when they hit, they really, really hit. But I think for some of the lesser talked about publishers, there's a company called Vari, V-A-R-I-E, which is, it's funny because a lot of the times their games are the ones that people fire up in an emulator, say, oh, this is kind of clunky, and then turn it off. But they tried things nobody else was trying. And I give them a ton of credit just for that, right? They had some really interesting, unusual games, even if they weren't always the best games.
So. Yeah. And for context on that, folks, definitely go back and listen to the previous episode. If you haven't yet, we did talk about that, that notion of like picking a ROM off a list. Right. And then, we dipped in a little bit into that idea of like trying new things, that sense of risk, uniqueness that is beneficial, even if the risk doesn't ultimately pay off. You know, so if that interests you, definitely check out the previous episode.
Well, I mean, there's definitely a lot to check out. I already have a whole list of questions. I did have one question, if you don't mind me going back quick. We were talking about obviously the magazines that specifically influenced you. And I've been looking. See, something I realized even just a year ago is that a lot of Famitsu's magazines from the 80s and 90s are all available on Internet Archive. And the thing that struck out to me the most during that time, and it still does to this day, is the usage of color. And when I downloaded the free sample of your book, Joe, the thing that popped out to me was the use of color. And I do want to just, again, just for my own framework of just like being kind of not aesthetics junkie, but this is the use of color palettes I always find incredibly interesting, either in box arts, magazines, and a lot of the way that they present games before you actually play them. And if there is like a particular color or even maybe just art style that influences you a lot when making this book.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. So Famitsu. Oh boy, there's like three answers in that. First I'll sort of tackle the Famitsu side of things, which is, there is a manga artist, Susumu Matsuda, I think his last name was, if I got it wrong, sorry. But he's actually the guy that did Master Takahashi or Master Higgins from Adventure Island. He's the artist that created that character. He was kind of the go-to artist for Famitsu. He designed their mascot. He did a ton of the interior work. And so he's just kind of become this really well-known figure within games of that era. And he sort of set that the cartoonish kind of custom style that makes a Famitsu magazine feel like Famitsu.
Yeah.
But outside of his work, kind of the Japanese magazines really did, like, they had a lot of color and a lot of pop, and they were a lot brighter, I would say, yes, than U.S. magazines were. American magazines tend to use a lot of dark backgrounds, whereas the Japanese magazines tend to use a lot of kind of bright, colorful backgrounds. Japanese, you'd find more white pages with black text on them. American magazines, you'd find more darker pages with white text on them. And so like looking at the two, there was a significantly different style. And what I've kind of done inside the book, which is kind of very much a stylistic choice on my part, is this is a book attempting to make it like the games that had been released in Japan were also released in the West, and this book's pages are the pages of magazines reporting on those games.
Yeah.
And so because of that, I have adopted more of the Western style from gaming magazines like EGM, but occasionally throwing in sort of pops and references and sometimes complete scans from magazines like Famitsu and Famicom Hishoban, to try and bring the Japanese into it, but to make a book that feels like a Western love letter to Japanese games. And what's funny is if you take like EGM, it was the Western version of Famitsu in all but name. It was very clear that they were getting Famitsu magazines, studying their layouts and copying them on the EGM side, complete with their format of doing kind of reviews as four vertical boxes with a score inside of each one from four different reviewers. There's this layout was totally a Famitsu layout. And so I guess the point there is that I'm sort of crossing the two designs, but leaning towards the Western feel with pops of the Japanese.
Is that because
feel.
You feel like it's an accessibility thing where you think you have more of your actual audience who's going to be reading the book more familiar with that style? Or do you think it's just a good way to combine two different elements that have just been influential in your research?
I think accessibility is not the way I would describe it as much okay. as an artistic flourish.
Okay,
and by
no,
that,
that's a good
way to describe
it.
Yeah, the goal is for this to feel like a Western celebration of Japanese games. So if mm-hmm. I were to take all of my inspiration from the Japanese magazines, then it would feel like I've translated Japanese magazines. And that's not yeah. really the goal I'm going for as much as sort of a Westerner's celebration of it.
Okay. Brilliant too, okay. because Good who answer. Are you selling the book to?
Exactly.
Westerners, right.
Yeah, exactly. So using that aesthetic, you know, they're not going to be familiar with the games already, but then using the design philosophy that they are familiar with, that just makes a lot of sense. It seems like the best possible choice. And kind of interesting as well that the design philosophy of these two regional types of magazines also seems to flow into games themselves. I'm sure we can all remember a time when Western games became obsessed with, very, very dull colors, browns, earthen colors, grays.
Time.
Yeah, you remember the gray years? When everything had like a guy contrast. With his back facing the yes. viewer on the cover with like two weapons down. The Bloodborne stance yeah. was like...
But the fun thing about kind of 92 to 94 EGM is that while it did use dark colors, it also still used colors, right? We hadn't
yes,
yet got into
you.
The brown skies era.
Yeah.
And so you look at the backgrounds and they do like, you know, beveled cubes that go from blue to pink to purple,
yeah.
right? And they'd use star fields and all of this stuff, but with like a colorful nebula through it. They would use all of these patterns that actually had pops of color. They just leaned to the darker side.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally makes sense. Yeah, post 2000, I think, is when we got that.
Yeah.
Well, okay, let's jump in here to kind of warm up for all the Mario talk. I would like you to rank these four games, if you would. And for the sake of just this question, we'll use the North American kind of naming conventions here. So would you please rank Super Mario Brothers 1, Super Mario Brothers 2, Super Mario Brothers 3, and Super Mario Brothers The Lost Levels. Let's have Joe go first. I almost want Joe to go last. What do you think, Crit?
I think we should save Joe for last. I think
Joe for last. Yeah.
Do you want to go first? Or do you want me to go
no,
first?
No, you go first. Go
you
first.
Want, okay. I was gonna say you want the viewers to be mad at me first. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to
well,
make
that
it
depends
quick and
on
easy.
What your answer
very
is.
Very minimal explanation here. Lost Levels, okay. Dead Last. I'm not okay. even sorry. That's fourth. This is where it's going to get tricky.
Dicey, right? Yeah.
This is where we're going to get a little dicey. It is very, very close between Super Mario Brothers 2 and 1 because I love both games a lot. I will put Super Mario Brothers 2 in third out of the four. But I want to note that it's incredibly, it's a lot closer than you would think to Super Mario Brothers 1. We'll probably get into in the episode my experience with Super Mario Brothers 2, especially with the cast ensemble, in which the time I played it, it was actually one of the first video games I played. But the reason why it is not ranked second, even though I love the color, the music, the cast ensemble, was because one of my first video games I ever played was Super Mario Brothers 1. Which I am going to put in second. It introduced me to platformers. It introduced me to the most iconic music and series that is just a staple for me and just been a major influence in my life. But without, again, I'm not going to give too much explanation for all of this, but Super Mario Brothers 3, I think, is the perfection of the entire formula of platforming for the NES era. I think that was when Miyamoto was at his peak. I think his design team just knew exactly what they wanted. They understand the limitations and the capability of their console, and they executed it perfectly as a swan song transitioning into the Super Nintendo. So Super Mario Brothers 3 is going to be my number one. So one is Super Mario Brothers 3, second is Super Mario Brothers 1, third is Super Mario Brothers 2, very close to Super Mario Brothers 1. Lost Levels is not even close to any of them, but we'll get into that. Why?
Excellent, excellent. Okay, and then I'll take a shot. I will also take your perspective. I'll go from worst to best. So I would say Lost Levels is dead fourth. I put out this question to Twitter. We got a lot of responses. I was baffled every time somebody put Lost Levels in first place. But it's an opinion question.
I get it. So no, and totally, I do. Yeah. We'll talk about it. I do get it.
Yeah, yeah. there's a level of satisfaction there if you can do it. But like for me, I just thought it was a hateful game. Like it hated me, yeah, is what I mean. You know, like put it on with the All-Stars version and just like, why? What are it you doing? Anyway, yeah,
we'll get into it. We'll get into it.
Yeah. Lost Levels last is tricky. 2 and 1, where to place them, right?
I know.
I'm going to say 2, then 1 as well. Same. Okay. Same with you. The reason for that is 1 saved an industry.
Yes, I should have mentioned that. Yeah. No, good point.
1 was a launch title for one of the greatest systems ever made. 2 is a fantastic Mario game. It's also very much unlike a Mario game in a lot, yeah, of ways. But it did contribute a lot. Excellent music, great gameplay, love Floaty Peach.
Great enemies.
But yeah, I got to give it to Mario 1. And then, of course, at the top, Super Mario Brothers 3. Come on. Like, Mario Brothers 3, I also think, is one of those games that's darn near perfect, if not it. I always like to compare it to Mario World, which a lot of people really, yeah, love. I love Mario World. There's not a ton of difference between Mario World and Super Mario Brothers 3. They're really, really, really close. You know, there's a lot of vertical design in Mario 3. There's a lot of different options for power-ups and a lot of secrets and things like that, pathways and such. You just don't have Yoshi, you know, and it's on 8-bit instead of 16-bit. But really, really close games. And I think that's super impressive for Mario 3 on NES to be standing shoulder to shoulder with a Super NES game.
Yes, I agree.
I would love to do an episode on Mario 3 eventually. That's the creme de la creme as far as I'm concerned. A couple people put Mario 3 last, and I want you to know I love you as a human being. Stop. But we can't see eye to eye.
Yeah, no.
Now watch Joe put it last. Hey, Joe.
I'm nervous.
Yeah.
I'm nervous.
So,
but he's an expert, so like I really, yeah, really nervous, right, about this, yeah,
one. So I have to. I mean, obviously, I have to predicate my answer with this is personal favorites. I would rank them differently, okay, if I was attempting to look at them as which one, like for example, Red, you brought up Mario 1 saved an industry. Uh-huh. It did. Yes. But I'm ranking my personal favorites.
Right.
Which is that's true. Fair. That's fine. What, no, and that's a good way to do it.
It is fair because I did not specify for this. I don't think. I just said rank them because, yep, people can apply their different modes of interpretation. For me, that's history. That's, yes, intrinsic, insane, quality. That's favorites. All of that kind of plays in. But if somebody wants to just operate on just favorites, that's also totally acceptable. It's a, absolutely, it's a throwaway question. So go ahead. Let's hear your.
All right. Your, so let's start with last. It is Super Mario Brothers 2, i.e. the Lost Levels, if you want to call it that.
Okay.
However, unlike you guys, I enjoy Super Mario Brothers 2. We'll get, that's into, fair, that.
Wait, now you enjoyed Lost Levels. Is that what you're saying?
No, I enjoyed, okay, Super Mario Brothers 2.
Okay, we did also. I want to, okay, make that clear. Yeah, I, okay, loved Super Mario Brothers 2. It's, no, just, no, you got to, no, put, no, it somewhere, you know?
Oh, okay. I mean Super Mario Brothers 2, the thing that Nintendo later called the Lost Levels.
Okay.
Okay, got it.
That's one of the... I'm being clear about that because the Lost Levels is the Super Nintendo port,
right,
which is considerably worse than the original Famicom Disk System release.
Okay, so I think to make this to make this doable, we'll have to do two things. three things. Let's do Mario 2 USA for the NES release of Mario 2. Let's do Mario 2 Japan for the original form of Lost Levels, right? And then let's do Lost Levels for the Super Nintendo. That's going to be what most people have played.
Yes.
Probably is the All-Stars re-release of Japanese Mario 2. And then obviously we've got Doki Doki Panic. So we're talking about four different games here.
Great. Okay. Let's do it that way.
Got it.
Okay. So, to start over then with that. So last place, Mario 2 Japan.
Okay.
I did enjoy Mario 2 Japan. But it is last place of those four, and for reasons we'll be talking about for the next while. My next one up is Super Mario Brothers 1.
Okay.
And you know, it's I agree with you. It changed an industry. It saved an industry. But do I want to sit down and play it again over Mario 2 or Mario 3? Mm-hmm. Let's say less often.
Right. Totally makes sense.
I agree with that.
Yep. So next one up, Super Mario Brothers 3.
Oh,
yep.
Okay. Now, I did get a taste of this in the in the thread.
Yeah. So Mario 3 is great. I mean, you're right. It is one of those few games that is near perfect. Another one of those games that is equally near perfect is Super Mario World for the Super Nintendo. Mm-hmm. And I would rank Mario World higher than Mario 3, which means that I can get that great, perfect balance between playful and technical platforming that both of those games require in more than one place.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So my top one, awesome, being Super Mario Brothers 2, is because that is an experience that is unique to Super Mario Brothers 2. It didn't become the genre standard. It didn't become the game that everybody else cloned. And because of that, I can sit down and replay Mario 2/Doki Doki Panic over and over again and get an experience no one else is giving me.
Yes. And I think that's totally, it's such a on point Joe answer because it's emphasizing your personal preference for the unique. And when you look at these four games, which one's the most unique?
I mean, it's not even debatable.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just completely clear.
It's obviously Mario 2 USA. That game is very unique. I mean, it's the fever dream game. You know, it really is. Well, that is a respectable ranking, though. The folk who put Mario 3 last, I'm like, I can't. No, okay. Here's the worst ranking that I saw in the entire thread. I'm not gonna call out any name, but this is the worst ranking in the entire thread. There was a guy who said all of them are the worst. Mario sucks.
Okay, fair. I mean, and I was fair, like, at that point.
I was like, just didn't even respond. And which is rare for me, okay? You know, not to toot my own horn, but here I go. I will fight with people a lot of times, especially if they don't answer the question. Simple question, right? But I didn't respond to that because it's ignorable. Mario sucks. Are you kidding me? Anyway, all right. Remember your blood pressure, Red. let's talk a little bit about Doki Doki. So, you know, like I said, we've got essentially four games that we're kind of juggling here. Lost Levels, Super Nintendo, Mario 2 USA, Mario 2 Japan, and then kind of the heart of this podcast is Doki Doki Panic. Yume Kojo Doki Doki Panic. What is Doki's relationship to Mario 2? It's in the title of the podcast, right? Is what most people think of, which is it's just a reskin. You know, Mario 2 USA is just a reskin of Doki Doki Panic. Now, the more you kind of examine that beyond the "Did you know?" videos that we're kind of bombarded with from YouTube culture, There's a lot of detail in there. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to defer to our expert.
Exactly. I mean, that's what we should be doing.
Yes. But there are some questions along these lines. Dadum said, did you know that MageCast X is just MageCast with an extra X at the end?
It's true.
It's true. It is. It's cool that SMB2 is what it is, but everything about it has been thoroughly embedded into various Mario games. I think the better question in the West is, what was Doki Doki Panic supposed to be? So Joe, thoughts on this? I think you've been adequately mysterious, with all of this.
Oh man. Yeah. So, just a little on my experience with these games,
yes.
Super Mario Brothers 2 / Japan, Super Mario Brothers 2 USA and Doki Doki Panic are three games in which I have 100%ed. Okay. And so, all three of those games, I'm a big fan of, let's just say. But on the in the side of Doki Doki Panic, we all sort of talk about it like it's Super Mario Brothers 2 was just a reskin of it. And I mean, yeah, kind of. But there are a number of significant differences. Now, I'm not going to be the guy with the microscope going in and saying, oh, in world 1-1, if you go in a door in this spot, the mushroom is one square over to the left and stuff like that, right?
Yeah. There's two
the cutting
Goombas
room floor
instead of
has
one.
A ton of that kind of stuff in which people have gone through and just picked apart the differences between the games. But there were a couple of really big, significant ones that are worth addressing. Mm-hmm. One is, of course, the characters. Now, Doki Doki Panic was originally an internal prototype, and no one quite knows exactly why it was being built. The theory is that it was a different experiment on potential Mario 2 to begin with. And a lot of that comes from an old interview where they said that they were trying to create a Mario type game with vertical scrolling instead of horizontal scrolling. And like that very well might have been the case. Like if you look in games industries, that's pretty common to go in and try out a couple of different takes on a new game. And Doki Doki Panic might have been a new Mario. But if it was, it was changed very quickly to match with a licensing deal Nintendo got with Yume Kojo Festival in Japan, which was this huge, like year-long festival done by FCI, which is like Fuji Television. And like Nintendo basically took their mascots and put it in this game. So with that said, being switched over to Fuji meant that they were no longer locked to the Mario formula, if they ever were at all, which means there was no run button. Original Doki Doki Panic did not hold B to run. That's one of the big control gameplay differences that you find. The other major difference worth pointing out is that Doki Doki Panic had all four characters, just like Super Mario Brothers 2, but you couldn't change characters between levels. And so you actually had four different paths all being saved to the disc at once. So you play six levels in with one character, and then you reset, you choose a different character, you start back at level one, you could play forward with that character. And to get the true ending for Doki Doki Panic, you had to complete the game four times, once with each character. Which, you know, is a blessing and a curse. I do like the change they made in the West where you can choose your characters between levels, but it does mean that the original game was never balanced to have all of the characters be equally good, I guess you could say.
That's a really
good point. Peach is easy mode, and you can default to Peach on the US version and never have to use anyone else. But in Japan, if you default to the floating character, whichever one that was, that'll get you one quarter of the way through the game.
There's quite a bit there. I'd only heard about the whole mechanism of like having to do multiple playthroughs with each character only recently. It instantly reminded me of Super Mario Brothers 1, in which you could play through it several times, right? And I have not done this since I was like 8 years old, but each time it would replace enemies with the Hammer Bros, right? Okay.
Something like that.
So that you would play through it multiple times, eventually get to the hardest playthrough, and then would end. Something like that. Again, I haven't done that.
I actually haven't done that with Super Mario Brothers 1.
Okay.
Which is funny to think of how many times that I have played through that game, but never bothered with the second playthrough.
It changes
a lot of the stuff to the Beatles.
That's right. I've done it. This is how much time I spent at Showbiz Pizza. I've done it on the, I think it was the Versus Super Mario Brothers.
Ooh, that's a tougher one.
Yeah, it was, possibly, the first time I recognized Mario, because I didn't get an NES super early on. We were doing Commodore 64 and stuff like that. Didn't have an NES in the house. I remember when I did finally start playing Mario, because that crap's awesome. But I remember being in a Showbiz Pizza, I want to say it was, before it changed to Chuck E. Cheese in Hawaii Kai in near Honolulu. And they had an arcade cabinet for Super Mario, and it had to be the Versus Super Mario Brothers. But I remember getting through it, and then they started changing it to Beatles. I don't know how much of my poor grandmother's money I must have dropped in that machine in order to get that far into it. But you know what? I did just look up just now the names of the characters in Doki Doki Panic. They are the Arabian family, it says, and their names are Imogene, Lena, Mama, and Papa. So it appears that Imogene is the main character. Then that's your Mario. Lena, I believe, is the Peach analog. Mama seems to be Luigi, which is kind of funny because there's that whole meme, Mama Luigi, right?
I didn't even think of that.
Yeah. Now that's where they came from. And then there's Papa, which is Toad. Then that's at a glance. Again, I've not played it. Can you confirm at all, Joe, if the woman in blue plays like Luigi, or did they have kind of varying play styles in Doki Doki?
Oh no, they had the same play styles.
Okay,
for sure. Honestly, it's been long enough that I can't confirm that the person wearing this color has this ability set. That's
totally understandable.
But I think the sprites were fairly similar. So if you're looking at the sprite and it looks somewhat like the character that it ended up.
Yes. Yeah.
Then, yeah, it probably matches.
sounds about right. And Wart apparently was Mamu. Mm-hmm. In Doki Doki. So
he actually ended up in later Zelda games and cameos under that name.
Yes. So in my favorite Zelda game, Link's Awakening, you can encounter him. Here it is. Yeah, Imogene is the balanced character. Mario replaces him. Okay. Mama jumps higher and sort of slightly has like a slower jump. That's Luigi, right? And then Lena can hover. That's Peach. And Papa is the strongest and can run the fastest, so that's Toad. Perfect.
Cool.
It's really interesting to see, kind of these original analogs and what changed and what didn't. I want to give a shout out here to TG Contrarian, who said, how many people do you think know that Doki Doki Panic basically started as a Mario sequel before Nintendo got into an agreement with Fuji Television? And he shared a clip from a wiki somewhere. I'm not sure if this is actually Wikipedia or if it's a fan wiki. But just in brief, it said the Doki Doki Panic engine started as a Mario-style tech demo using vertical scrolling mechanics as opposed to side-scrolling mechanics. They do, fortunately, have a little footnote there that you can check out. Miyamoto suggested the inclusion of side-scrolling mechanics to make it more of a Mario concept. Nintendo entered a licensing deal with Fuji, and the game's development proceeded with the Yume Kojo characters, which is sort of what Joel was saying here as well. So that, I think, is something that a lot of people don't know and don't actively discuss. What you tend to find, or at least what I tend to find anecdotally, is that when you mention Mario 2 USA, there's a reductionist attitude, right? Where people will say, well, it's just a reskin, you know? Instead of saying it's a reskin, the just is revealing of people's attitude towards Mario 2, as if we just kind of got leftovers, you know? We didn't really get the real deal, which will obviously play into our discussion later.
I think it's worth noting that from the developer standpoint, nearly every game is a reskin of the original prototype. As in, we, you know, if we're focused on gameplay first, we come up with a game and then we figure out all of the kind of the story and the characters and the art and all of that stuff, especially back in the day when gameplay was absolutely king and story was kind of secondary, right? You rarely start with a script. So like the thing that I find interesting about that clip that TJ Contrarian put up is that it is actually fairly carefully worded, started as a Mario style concept, and that Miyamoto wanted to make it more of a Mario idea, right? Mm-hmm. It's not that it's necessarily started as a Mario game. We don't have that insight.
Right.
But the insight that we have is that it started as a Mario style concept, a Mario style game, and then got skinned with Arabian themed characters for Yume Kojo, and also got skinned with Mario characters for an American release. So it's not just a reskin. The skin is what gives it its personality on top of a core set of mechanics that were prototyped first.
That was very well worded. They're being careful with the words to it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Again, it avoids the generalizations, the reductionist attitude that is not just prevalent with discussing Mario 2 USA, but a lot of games. You know, there's a lot of generalist statements out there. So I'm happy that we're cutting through all that here. Now, a couple questions here on changes. This is from Terrence Harkin. During localization, many changes were made to Doki Doki Panic, down to the music. Many tunes are longer in Super Mario Bros. 2, but would you have rather they gone ahead and used the prototype's rendition of the Super Mario Bros. 3 underground theme or the more fleshed out version of the Doki Doki Panic music they used in the final release? This is a super specific question.
All right. I'm very curious what the answer will be to that.
Right. What do you think, Joe? Should they have just used the original Doki Doki music, or are you fine with the music that they used?
So this is so specific.
I know, right?
Nate Terrence Harkin, he hangs out in our chat all the time. This is 100% a Nate question. This is just to let you guys know. He's great.
I tend to defer to the developers and the designers for things like this. Like, there are numerous reasons as to why music might change. Everything from stylistic approaches to memory on the cartridge to a particular person on the team having issue with it to a potential overlap with a popular piece of music that is still within copyright. Like, there's so many reasons as to why music might change during development that if the question is, do I like one piece better than the other? I didn't sit down and listen to the two. But if the question is, should they have stuck with one versus the other, I tend to just defer to the developers know what they're doing, I would hope.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly.
That's a great answer. Yeah. Here's another one. Joypad Lad Shop. What changes were made to the code of the game that aren't as obvious as the graphical makeover? So far we know, obviously, they changed the characters. They changed some sprites. Some of the music was changed. You did mention there's the whole idea of having to play through the game four times that we didn't get in Mario 2 USA. Are there any other major changes to the game that you can think of?
So there's one other major change worth noting, and it actually is a contrast for cartridges versus the Famicom disk system, which is the disk system were writable disks by default, which means it had a save game. So the American version of Super Mario Bros. 2, I mean, they couldn't have done the four playthroughs required to fully complete the game without sticking a battery in the cartridge. But in Japan, there is, you know, it was on disk system, so you could save right to the disk. And I got lucky. One of the reasons I can say that I did truly 100% Doki Doki Panic is that when I ordered my copy, so it's really hard to find sealed, quote, sealed stuff from Japan because they didn't seal their games.
Oh, interesting.
So when you buy a boxed game, it's not in plastic. And you don't know if it's ever been played or not. And so when I bought a copy of Doki Doki Panic, it was a boxed copy, but I didn't know how much it had been played. And I put the disc in my console and it was empty, which means it was a brand new copy. Now, Doki Doki Panic, as far as I'm aware, had no way to delete your save once it was on the disc. It was there for good. And so I was the one that got to ruin that disc by unlocking everything in it, which I had a lot of fun. I sat down and marathoned that baby just so that I could completely ruin that disc. But yeah, it's the fact that it had a save game was that would have been handy in the West because it was that was a long game. It had a ton of levels and the levels were unusually long.
And that's pretty incredible. I imagine if you were savvy enough, you could pop that thing open and figure out how to delete that data, maybe, or always take a hammer to it or something like that. Okay, next kind of big question here. Do you think Nintendo was right that Lost Levels, aka Mario 2 Japan, really was too hard? Now that makes the assumption, obviously, that that's the reason why they didn't bring, you know, Lost Levels or Mario 2 Japan over, and instead we got Mario 2 USA. I'm sure that, you know, this being a company, there being several creatives involved, boards involved, all kinds of things, that there is multitudinous reasons. Yeah. But one of the kind of the main reasons that persists in general consensus is that sort of in the vein of Final Fantasy Mystic Quest, say, and Final Fantasy V. You know, that V was too hard to be enjoyed by Western audiences, and so we got, you know, Final Fantasy USA instead. Is there any interjection you'd make on that, Joe? I'm sure you would. Before we start to get into the actual answers that people supplied to that question, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
So I will say, I definitely think we should look at user answers first, because boy, do I have a lot to say about this topic.
Oh, really? Okay. But, well, you know what we could do actually is kind of break down your thoughts in response to some of these, if you like.
Yeah, that's probably the best way to do it.
Because, yeah, there's a – so I put out this question. It was one of those that – like, again, all, like 200 people responded. And I just want to say, folks, I really appreciate it when you do respond to questions like these, especially when we get a bulk of answers. It allows us to see trends. It allows us to see, you know, kind of groupings of answers, which I think is really fascinating. I also reserve the right to disagree with people's answers because I'm a human being. You know, like one person, I made a little joke. Oh, I think it was for the ranking one. Somebody was like, shout out to people who put 2 above 3. And I was like, shout at people who put 2 above 3. And they're like, hey, you're supposed to only be answering the question here. Don't color the answers. And I was like, I'm just joking. I can't, you know, I can't avoid wordplay. It's delicious. so, but also I'm a person that has opinions too. Go ahead, Joe.
For sure. Yeah. So actually, do I have an interjection? Actually, it yes. might be useful to kind of paint a picture and set the stage
yes.
for the world that Super Mario Brothers 2 Japan was released into, because that picture is something that I think a lot of these answers, I mean, some of them have it, a lot of them lack it, because we didn't live there. We didn't live then, and most people haven't gone back and studied it.
Okay, so let me ask you a clarification on that then. When you say the world that Mario 2 Japan was released in, you're talking specifically about the Japanese gaming market at the time.
The Japanese gaming market in 1986.
Got it. Okay. Okay. Perfect.
Yes.
Yes.
So, Super Mario Brothers 2 was absolutely not the first time that this idea of let's take the original game and basically create the next worlds came up. So there was a bit of a trend. You saw it in Super Zevius. You saw it in Lode Runner Championship Edition, where they would create games that were the next one, the sequel, but actually for the people who had got everything in the first one. And like, we can look back at that now and say that was a design flaw, but that was actually a pretty common occurrence back then, to sort of make the next game be the follow-up of the previous one. Some games, like the Wizardry series, went as far as actually allowing you to use your save game from the previous game in the next one. So that was one aspect that we don't really consider now, that the people making Super Mario Brothers 2 were still in a world in which that was kind of considered acceptable. Mm-hmm. In addition, it was released in 1986, which means that Doki Doki Panic, of course, had not been released yet, and neither had a ton of these other games, which were sort of improvements on the platformer formula. This was a year after we got the first Super Mario Brothers. And so, like, a lot of the things that we can look back at now and say, they should have done this, they should have done this. Miyamoto was actually still kind of a fledgling designer. Yeah, he had a number of games under his belt, but he also only had 3 years of video game design or 4 years of video game design under his belt, right?
At that point,
that's a hard bet.
And so this was a world in which Nintendo was still learning, and they introduced a game that fit the kind of the standard of the time. And now we can look back and say, boy, that standard was wrong. But I think within that context, it's interesting to see what other people say, because we could contrast sort of how we see it as modern Westerners from how the Japanese may have seen it in 1986.
Yeah. And I think that there's two ways that you can come at saying, if you want to use terms like wrong and right, right in that Japanese context for a young developer, you know, kind of to get something out to, especially wrong in, it seems like Nintendo thought it was wrong for North America, and that's why they didn't send it over right away. And I think that kind of falls back on what we were looking at last episode with a contrast between the NES, particularly here in North America, and the Famicom in Japan. Certainly. So like there's so many layers, right? Certainly like a lot more adult players, it seems like, in Japan. You'd mentioned speed running in a thread in Japan. Whereas here in America, like we mentioned in the last episode, the NES was very much in the boys' toys section. A lot of the commercials with, like, you know, the kids with the baseball caps on backwards and shades, like, yeah, Mario's cool, you know, and stuff like that.
I want to also interject, and I think Joe makes and probably the most important point of what I'm sure came down to it, which was how long was Nintendo even involved in game development as a company with Miyamoto, who was a young designer, and how much did they have enough information about a Western audience that was just overcoming the great video game crash of 1983? So having to make decisions on, like, these are the kind of titles that we think a Western audience would like. I don't know if Nintendo at the time even had that correct information, because they were just kind of hot off the presses off the original Super Mario Brothers. But you make a good point, Joe. They weren't even involved in game development that long as a company. This was a company that was founded in, what, the late 1800s? And they only had gotten into the video game market, I'm probably going to get my information wrong, but I'd say late 70s is when they first really started exploring it more. So
they did, but Miyamoto really didn't.
Like, and then you have Miyamoto himself.
Yeah. Like, until what, 81, 82 is when he was building Donkey Kong. So
exactly. So yeah. I just want to highlight that point that Joe is making, because that is something I wish someone said to me when I was being introduced into Lost Levels, because that's a good point. Yeah. It really, I think, is a good context.
Yeah, Howard Phillips was able to sit down and look at Super Mario Brothers 2 and Doki Doki Panic, compare the two, and say, well, this game is clearly better. Mm-hmm. But in 1986, nobody could do that because the second game didn't exist yet.
Exactly. Right.
Right. Which, which is a great time to not send it over because there was no kind of option to choose between. Mm-hmm. I really tend to think it was the right decision. Eventually when the decision was presented, you know, to bring it over or not. Some folk talked about us kind of being deprived of it. But, you know, when did All-Stars come out? It's a couple of years later. Is it 593? There it is. Yeah, 1993. And we got Super Mario Bros. 2 in... 88.
Damn it. Oh, I was close.
Pal didn't get it till 89. So, Pal didn't... Oh, Pal got Super Mario All-Stars in 93 as well. So, yeah. 5 years, 4 years. That's not too long. But we did get it eventually. I personally don't feel like I was deprived, particularly when we're talking about this game. But
I still have my opinions, but...
Yeah, I also think that there's layers of like layers of kind of like qualitative statements that we can make about this game as well. That like so I personally to kind of piggyback on what Joe was saying, I don't think and I haven't historically thought about Lost Levels as being bad because it's too similar to Super Mario 1. Some of the folks. Answers that we did make that point, and I thought it was interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't think that that's really the badness of its design. Now with what Joe's mentioned, you know, in the timetable and the Japanese, you know, context and all that, it makes sense for the similarity between Mario 1 and Mario 2 Japan.
I feel like that's a weird comparison though. Because Ninja Gaiden 2 was incredibly similar to Ninja Gaiden 1, right? As are a ton of other games in which we kind of look back at them and say, oh yeah, the sequel was even better than the original, when in fact it was the original plus some. And one could easily make the argument that Super Mario Bros. 2 Japan was the original plus some. The question is was the things that it added good?
Yeah, what's the sum, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
The point that I'm trying to make is that there's not prerequisite, precedent. There is precedent for that sort of thing. So when somebody says but Ninja Gaiden or but Castlevania, I agree. Like whether we're talking about the Japanese context as you did, Joe, or that we're talking about the worldwide context, there's precedent for those things. No argument there. I think that I don't think that the BS level design is it being so similar. I think the BS level design is that sum, right? So like exactly. What Joe said is it's one plus sum. Well, what is the sum? Just adding sum isn't necessarily a bad thing. Adding sum to a good game, if the sum is good, can be good. Adding BS to a good game may not be the best thing.
Which is important in video game design when you evaluate it, because it comes from a time where the idea was adding a sum to it. It on pen and paper should be a better game then, because there is more included in, I think, the Lost Levels than I think the first one did. But how it's laid out, how the entire design of it is incorporated into the actual player experience. And I don't know how obviously it was. I don't know what the reception was in Japan as much, obviously, compared to Westerners that played it on Super Mario All-Stars. But a lot of what the sum was of what was added made the experience more frustrating and less accessible. Yeah. So,
and people don't even agree about the consensus of the All-Stars version. Like,
the All-Stars version is different.
And like, if you look at this thread, there's people who are like, I love the All-Stars version. And there's people who are like, I hated the All-Stars version. So like, there's not even a consensus as far as that version either. Let's look at a couple of these answers and we can comment on a few of them. Kind of build this. I love that we kind of, you know, set the field up as it were.
So a beer and a game. First of all, I love that name. And then second of all says, for the answer of do you think the Nintendo was right that Lost Levels was really too hard? Beer and a game says, yeah, that's way too much BS level design.
That's the sum.
Which is fair.
Right.
That's fair.
That is the sum for sure. The it's funny because I feel like one of their biggest mistakes when it comes to level design, what I consider a mistake anyway, is that Super Mario Brothers 2 was willing to prank the player.
Yes.
And the player wasn't always in on the joke.
Right.
And I get that for somebody who has played through all 32 levels of the original Super Mario Brothers, beaten the game, and now wants to play this new game. In a way, you could look at some of those pranks, like the backwards warps and stuff, as sort of, you know, Red, you and I and Quest Guy do to each other on Twitter all the time, which is poke at each other. And that's but the thing is that everybody's got to be in on the joke, or it's just being mean.
Right.
I think when we call it BS level design, it's because, like, if you didn't sign up to be pranked, really annoying. And
here's exactly what you're saying is somebody will go, oh, but we have Kaizo Mario now. What's
but
the
you
difference?
Signed up for that.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know what to expect going into it. It's not about accessibility.
You called it Kaizo Mario. The fact that you added that clarifier is the admission that this is something additional to Super Mario. Like, they didn't call Super Mario Brothers 2 Kaizo Mario. You know, whatever Kaizo means. Do you know what Kaizo means? I don't.
I actually don't know what Kaizo means, but it absolutely is inspired by what Mario 2 did.
Right.
Because it's like the fans are going to do what Nintendo didn't.
Right. And it's mean-spirited. I've played Kaizo levels in Mario Maker and Mario Maker 2, and I think they're awful. But they're also hilarious because it's designed to be that way. Mario 2 is not hilarious because I love how you phrased it, Joe. You're not in on the joke.
Exactly. Right.
It doesn't feel good to, you know, go from playing Mario 1 and then you play Mario 2 and you're like, cool, a purple mushroom? I wonder what it does. And it just murders you.
Exactly. You know?
That's
so just you know, like I've said earlier in this chat, I do enjoy Super Mario Brothers 2, but it's because I allowed myself to get in on the joke.
Right.
Exactly. And once you do, it there's a lot of really funny, oh man, it got me again moments in that game. But yeah, that's not what people signed up for.
And not not what children signed up for, which I think
Exactly.
Is key
and that's the
to
thing
the
that
North
I think
American.
Of.
Yeah.
And as it's still supposed to be an introduction to a platforming genre. I mean, it's still early enough within the cycle of the console in which it's still going to be, at the time which it was released, going to be probably one of the first platforming games that young children would be exposed to. And if you look at the elements that are incorporated into Lost Levels, it's just it's not clear. It's not designed in a way that I think allows kids to really use their brain to understanding how platforming works, even though there are additions to the formula. And I feel weird because I'm sure there were kids in Japan that played this game before playing the original one. Not a lot of them, but still probably at least a few. And just thinking of it that way, like, what was their introduction then to the entire series if they started with this one?
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's you know, I mentioned Super Zevius, Championship Lode Runner, Mario Brothers 2, Japan, all of these games that sort of started where the last game ended.
Yeah.
All made an assumption that every person buying the game had beaten the previous game. And there's absolutely not always the case, especially in a new industry like video games were at the time. But even now, when we're coming up with a sequel for a game just within a game studio, the question is always, okay, I've got this game. And let's say, just for ease of numbers, the original sold 500,000 units. This, if the sequel does not attract any new customers, you're going to sell less than 500,000 units because you're not going to bring back all your previous customers. And so you have to replace those customers that you lost between games with new incoming customers. And that was something that the early games industry didn't understand, is that you have to replace the people who fall off. And Nintendo fell into that trap too of, oh, we're going to make this for the people who beat the last one, it's like, well, then you're going to lose customers. And luckily, Howard Phillips knew that and saw that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is why, this, again, seems like the right choice.
All right.
You've got the second one here.
I'll take the second one. Is Johnny 80 says, JP Mario 2 is basically side-scrolling Dark Souls. I fervently disagree. Dark Souls is a much better designed game.
I'm about to say, that's a no.
I think, to John's credit, I think he's appealing to the memory of it, right? Yeah. And Dark Souls now has become synonymous with difficulty. And I think, again, now we have that perspective of like, okay, now there's games that are designed to be super punishing. We've got Kaizo. We've got Dark Souls. In their own ways, they are difficult, right? Mm-hmm. Roguelites, you're supposed to die. But back then, for the follow-up to Mario 1, very different world, especially worldwide.
Yeah.
Well, and the big difference, I think, in between what Dark Souls does and what Mario 2 does is that Mario 2 doesn't give you a safety net. It pulls the rug out from under you and doesn't give you a net to fall into. Whereas Dark Souls has built a ton of systems into its game that you can opt into to make the game easier and easier and easier until you can complete it. Or even if you can't complete it, you could summon someone else to complete it for you.
Yeah.
And Mario 2 didn't have any of that.
So I hate to make this point, but just aesthetics, like you play a Dark Souls game just by the look, the art style, music, the feeling of it. Yeah, it's supposed to be this hard. When you put on Mario, you know, Mario 2, the Japanese version, it just doesn't feel like it's supposed to be that hard. It's still it has the upbeat, obviously iconic intro, like intro music that's synonymous with Mario games. It's just, it's a completely different atmosphere at that point, which I think matters.
And here's that difference too, is like by the time we played Mario 2, we played it as Lost Levels, and we'd already played Mario World and Mario 3 and Mario 2 and Mario 1. So we had a really kind of set idea of what Mario games and Mario himself is supposed to feel like. Did we already have the Mario movie?
No. When was that? That was 93. Mario movie was 93.
Oh my gosh, the same year of Lost Levels.
Yeah.
Okay. So potentially, you know, depending on when you might have picked one up or the other, you might have seen Super Mario Bros. The movie before playing Lost Levels or vice versa. And those would have been a little bit of a shock to the system.
I have my own opinions on All-Stars. I have my own opinion on Super Mario All-Stars, but I will keep them to myself for the time
being. Okay.
So do I, and I will keep them to myself for the time being.
Yeah, we'll get there. We'll get there. It's unfortunately, it's going to have to be the frame of reference for the vast majority of people with Mario 2. Yeah, even too, just generally with the All-Stars ports, I get it. Mm-hmm. They're not necessarily my favorite. Anyway, 16-bit nostalgia.
Lost Levels was particularly bad. We'll get there. Anyway.
Right. We'll get there. 16-bit nostalgia says, it depends who you ask. I love this answer. Definitely not a game for the casual player, but for those seeking a challenge, players were eating good with this. But as with many games of the time, muscle memory, focus, patience were key. As a dubious center.
I mean, I see the point.
Right.
But I'll let Joe, I want Joe to answer this one if he has an opinion on this before I say anything.
So again, the question was whether or not Nintendo was right to say it was too hard to release in the West, which means that the context is 1988. And we were eating good in 1988 already, right? We had Ninja Gaiden and we had Contra and we had Gradius. We had a bunch of really great hard games that we were playing in 1988.
You're answering what I was going to say.
So I don't feel like Super Mario Brothers 2 was the hard game we were all craving. I think this is probably good point to, or what's that?
No, I was just, I was thinking, I said, because I liked how you came at that.
Joe just has good answers to everything. That's why I keep deferring to him.
Yeah, it was the reverse of what I was thinking, because I was thinking not that, we already had other hard games, so we didn't need this one. I was thinking, but those other games aren't Mario.
Exactly.
Right?
Well, that's Well, I mean, that's part of it.
But that's kind of a great way to look at it, is those hard games weren't Mario. And so this put Nintendo, kind of Nintendo America in particular, into a position of asking, is Mario playful or is Mario technical? Mm-hmm. Because they had two games sitting in front of them, and one, Doki Doki Panic, was very playful and fun, and it was like you could make a lot of mistakes and still move forward, and it was just a playful world to play in. And then you had Super Mario Brothers 2 Japan, which is a highly technical platformer that requires pixel perfect precision at many points throughout the game, and it's constantly pranking you, and it's like, what kind of game do we want Mario to be? What do we want this IP to stand for? And I think that we were eating good already on the hard games front. And so Nintendo choosing to take Mario in the more playful route, I think is like how we got where we are now with Mario.
Exactly.
Beautiful.
Perfect.
Stop speaking so much sense, Joe, please.
I know. That's why
the heart can only take so much.
I can't even supplement that much to it, because he pretty much summarized all my opinions. All right, should we
there it is.
Wait, do I get quest? Do I get quest?
You get quest, guys.
Yeah.
You have to do his voice.
I'm doing it super
nasally, like sounds like Fran Drescher.
We'll give it
this is my payback, because he's always like, sound like Fran Drescher on stream. Like,
no, it's okay. I'll do this for you. This is for Quest 64 official. I was like 6 when we got the first Super Mario Brothers and a Nintendo. I guarantee the lost levels would have kicked my butt at that age. Which it would have. I can believe that. There you go.
Well, and it did. I mean, lost levels kicked my butt. I didn't beat lost levels until I was 30 something.
I never beat it. I only got like, I think, 3 levels into it.
Bro, when I was a kid and popped that crap into my Super Nintendo, I was like, I'm never going to beat this game. And that was it. And that was even with their little save continue thing in there.
I wish I could supplement anything that Quest has pointed, but it's just true. Like it just would have kicked. It did kick my butt.
Yeah.
For a very, very long time.
You had to have played Lost Levels first, right?
So I played the Super Nintendo version of Lost Levels and I hated it.
Yeah.
Okay.
It wasn't until I think I was 38 when I finally played the original Famicom Disk System version of Super Mario Brothers 2. Mm-hmm. And it's a good time to say, like I've said, I enjoy it. I've 100%ed it. And to put that into context, 100%ing the original Famicom Disk System version means completing the game 8 times, which unlocks worlds A through D, and then completing worlds A through D, which are even harder, and then completing the game without continuing to unlock world 9. So it is like it's basically becoming a speedrunner for that game is how you beat that game and 100% it. It is a game that is literally the play style is be a speedrunner.
Yeah.
But like, with that said, it kicked my butt when I was a kid, partially because of the horrible controls on the Super Nintendo version, but partially because I wasn't in a speedrunner-ish mindset when playing it. Mm-hmm. And I don't think any of us really were, right? We accepted, I brought this up earlier, but we accepted a lot of games, Contra being one of them, that were incredibly hard, and we loved them. Ghosts and Goblins, we loved them. And they were incredibly hard, but they didn't have the expectation that you become a speedrunner to beat it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that I've met people who have said they got their start speedrunning as a kid with rentals. Mm-hmm. One of my good friends, 8-Bit Steve, give him a little shout out here, is a guy who is a speedrunner now. He's a world record holder for many different NES games. He pretty much only plays NES, and he's very talented, very much an expert at NES. And his story as a kid is he would rent and beat games on a daily basis. And there was a store that knew him so well that he was able to just put kind of like a little down payment, get a chunk of games, beat them really quickly, bring them back really quickly, and then get a new chunk of games. And so that was like the young speedrunner in the making, but I don't think that that's the normative, to speak to Joe's point. No, I don't think that that's the normative experience that certainly a lot of North American players had. And I agree. It seems like Mario 2 Japan or Lost Levels is really designed for a specific kind of player. I don't think it's enough to just say, well, we had other hard games. There's a comment here that sticks perfectly with that. It's in the nay answers. So was Lost Levels too hard? Strange Vision says, I don't think so. The difficulty ramps up considerably, but as a kid, I would have pressed on anyway. We put up with harder games back then. Our expectations and our access to alternative games were different. It had Mario in the title. We'd have loved it. And I told him it had Mario in the title, and I didn't love it. I was 8 when Lost Levels came out, and I hated it. I thought it was awful, and I just played 3, 2, and 1 because I thought there were much better games. Now, again, that's anecdotal. I can't speak for everybody. There are people who love Lost Levels, who love the All-Stars version even.
So there's a great test that we can run on this. I'm sure there's at least a handful of your listeners who collect games. And if anybody is getting imports, one of the first, if they have a Famicom Disk System, one of the very first games that you pick up is Super Mario Brothers 2. So if anybody has a copy of Super Mario Brothers 2 listening to this, take a photo of the title screen and tag us in Twitter. And the reason is that the disc system version of Super Mario Brothers 2 tracks how many times that it has been beaten using stars on the title screen. And so it'll show up to 32 stars on their title screen, showing how many times that particular disc has been beaten. And especially if you personally have not beaten it, you can throw it into your disc system and see how many times its previous owners beat it. Because again, it can't ever be deleted off of that disc. It keeps its own history. And I'm pretty sure that if most people were to put a disc system copy of Super Mario Brothers 2 into their disc system, they would see 0 stars on the title screen.
Ooh.
And that would tell us a lot about not only the US version, but the Japanese versions, like how it, whether or not Japanese kids were really ready and willing to play like a speedrunner.
Interesting. Well, folks, call his bluff. Okay. If that's you,
if that's you. You got to prove him wrong. You know,
how I like that idea too. That's kind of brilliant. Like, hey, if this game is in your collection, you know, take a picture and tag us on Twitter. That's neat. Do but it. Here it has that extra utility.
True.
So, that's definitely great. Yeah. I don't think that merely it being a Mario game means that we would have loved it. Certainly that didn't work out for Philips CDI, right?
What do you mean? That's in my number one. What do you
Hotel,
mean?
Hotel. Yeah. Is your favorite
and
game?
My friend, yeah. And same my Zelda one. Zelda
but I think CDI. That there are some people who do genuinely love Lost Levels. I've met a couple of them and I believe them.
Yeah.
But I don't think that the majority of folks would. Like, I don't remember Lost Levels being a sensation when it hit All-Stars.
And it shouldn't be, in my opinion. I'm sorry. It shouldn't be.
It was a quirk. It was a talking point, right? Because everybody's like, wow, there was a super hard Mario game that didn't come out in the West. This is really cool. And then people would try it. And I remember they'd be like, oh, that's why it didn't come out in the West. Then we go back to playing the other
one. It was the Live Alive of the Mario series.
Yeah.
Wah, wah, wah. Okay, who's next on here?
Who was the next one? Was it me?
You read Quest 64?
Oh, no. No. Okay. You read Quest 64. Okay. It's me.
Oh, okay.
Intrepid Tautog, sorry if I got that wrong, says, I think the issue with Lost Levels is that it's the definition of too hard equals cheap deaths and annoying traps. Starts to feel like the developers are messing with you after a while.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah.
They're pranking us.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. there is an interesting note on that though, that I have my worries regarding Super Mario Brothers Wonder, and I know Nintendo is going to pull it off. But when I watched that trailer, I couldn't help but wonder if I pass by a flower or whatever, and it does some weird random thing inside the environment that I wasn't expecting, which seems to be the whole shtick of that game is hitting you with the unexpected. It runs the risk of feeling like Mario 2 Japan's pranks.
I see what you
and
mean.
And I trust modern Nintendo, but there's a little bit of nerves that I have in there.
I think
after watching that trailer.
I think that one key difference is Wonder will be nowhere near as hard as Mario 2 Japan. But I get what you're saying. I think that there's some requirement of like pre-existing knowledge, right? Like how can you tell what a prank is? Like, unless you know what a not prank is, you know, unless you know what the standard is. Like, you know, when you touch a flower in Super Mario, you typically get the fire flower. You know, I can throw fire. But if you touch a flower in Wonder and it turns into an acid trip, well, you can only know that that's a deviation from the normal if you know what normal is, right?
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. I like this this comment here from Film Objective. Film Objective is just these are all great comments. First of all, let's say Film Objective is a very thoughtful person. It said, I think it's the vibe more than difficulty, as other NES games are harder. But in thinking of Mario as America's antidote to the games crash, Nintendo was right to keep him apart from traditional player hostile designs. The vibe from SMB1 is that the designer is on your side.
That's a 10 out of 10 right there. Mm-hmm. I'll make a question.
Well, are we ranking? Just, are we rating?
That, I don't listen. I'm sorry. I'm running a little too hot on this, but that right there sums the entire argument up to me and my feelings on it. That's just perfectly worded. That's it. That's right. Just it to me.
Yeah. So yeah, nobody's saying that there were no other hard games on the NES. There were. That's patently obvious. It's demonstrably obvious. And again, what Joe was saying earlier, you know, making sure that they decide what kind of game, what kind of series Mario is going to be, and what he's going to represent. Now he kind of represents games for everyone, you know, to my mind. At least he represents the fun of gaming. He represents just that kind of a casual magic, you know.
He's an introduction. He's something to start. Even with sports games, like a lot of people got into sports games, you know, from the GameCube era. That was their introduction into sports genres. Yeah. I mean, it's just
racing.
It's just different. Yeah. Racing everything.
Yeah. Mario Kart. There's that great video that came out recently with Charles Martinet and Shigeru Miyamoto. There's one where Martinet calls Miyamoto Papa. He's like, Papa. I was like, oh. But there was a great line in there towards the end. Really, really just short line. It's totally Mario wisdom, right? Mario wisdom is not verbose. Mario wisdom is not cumbersome in its wordiness. Mario wisdom is simple. And he was just like, this character reminds us of our innocence. And I pinched out a little tear, I'll admit, when he said that. As I was like, that's it. That's the character right there. He's not a character that's going to play a prank on you. He's a character that's your friend.
Yeah.
That's it. He's just a nice guy. And I think that it took them time to build that reputation for Super Mario. But part of building that reputation was not putting Mario 2 Japan front and center, seems like.
I think this decision is what set that reputation, because if you think about the decisions Nintendo had to make before then, right? Mario appeared in Donkey Kong, and then the next decision that they made was, let's make Mario a bad guy in Donkey Kong Jr.
Right.
And so right then and there, they had not yet figured out who Mario was, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Then they introduce us to Mario Brothers and bring Luigi in and put Mario back into the hero position, only to make him the star of Super Mario Brothers 1. And like at this point, Mario's already been a good guy and a bad guy. And now he's got a brother, and it's him and his brother. And now all of a sudden, the next decision is Mario a character-driven, playful game, or is it a punishingly difficult platformer?
Yeah.
And so I feel like this was the next defining decision for Mario, is like, which direction should they go?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nope, I agree.
Totally well said. Well, so obviously those are answers that it select. There's a lot of answers. I'm sorry we couldn't include everybody's, but those were some of the answers that I picked out for the yay. Now we get to the nay. Everybody already knows what we think, right? But the beautiful thing about society is that there are people who don't have the same opinion on art and history and things like that. So these, I wanted to make sure that we didn't just highlight comments that we agree with, but here are some that present a different perspective on it.
For nay answers, right? And this is from Danzo Manzo 92. You only have to look at Western events such as AGDQ, as well as various other speedrunning tournaments, to know it was patient. It was, what was it, patently ridiculous, ridiculous decision. The rest of the world was more than accustomed to difficult platformers by that point, too. I do get that. I get that argument to a degree, but I think as we put it out, I think we laid it out perfectly in the earlier part of this episode. Yes, there were obviously clearly more difficult platformers and games that came out, especially at the time of its release, in which it could have been incorporated into an American audience. But it's the Mario brand. It's the Mario identity that I think going with the more accessible, more, I don't know, playful and design elements of, you know, Super Mario Brothers 2, the USA version, that influenced then, I think, later decisions with Super Mario Brothers 3, Super Mario Brothers World, going down the line that led to what the brand is today. So
yeah,
I get it. And just with AGDQ, it's like, it's about the time which it came out. It's about, to me, like, again, I have a very historian viewpoint of this. It's about when it came out, what was the context of the audience of who it had in mind. And it just, when I think of things like Games Done Quick, conventions that are like that, Games Done Quick is a very like early 2000s to like modern culture design element of like playing games and speedrunning it quickly. I'm thinking it within the context of like 1987, 1988. And yeah, things like GDQ just don't come to my mind at all.
Right.
But that's just me personally.
And Dan and I had an interesting kind of back and forth there after that comment that he shared. I said initially, I didn't realize GDQ was around in 1986, because we both know they weren't. And he laughed and said no. But there was a severe lack of foresight in estimating the potential impact of the game, given how popular retro titles are years later, in this case, decades later, and how world records are still sought. And I said, I really don't think even Nintendo could have predicted what gaming would look like 40 years later. But the point is, it was released in the mid-1980s, not the 2020s. And hindsight isn't 1980.
Can I also make a point with when it comes to the Games Done Quick? I don't think Nintendo has a good relationship with speedrunners even now. I don't Nintendo has a good... I got even into Twitch, into streaming, because I wanted to watch Super Mario Brothers 64 speedrun. I'm very involved in just being a part of... like, just being a part of the experience of what a lot of, like, Super Mario 64 speedrunners go through. At the heart of it, I think Nintendo has a stance that they do not like speedruns because they see it as breaking their games down to their core and exposing elements that they don't want the audience to look at.
Yeah,
so that's
not had
my
a great
stance
reaction
on that.
With
no, they don't
great
acknowledge it. Nintendo does
with,
not acknowledge speedrunning
scene stuff.
They don't acknowledge AGDQ. They don't acknowledge any of it.
Yeah, and
they don't even organize their
tournaments
own
and all that. Yeah, there's a lot there.
I want to just point out real quick, if Nintendo wanted to really focus on the element of speedrunning, like from a design standpoint, they would have done it already, and they would already be hosting their own speedrunning tournaments like GDQ. But they don't. Because right. I just don't think they want to incorporate it, and they don't see it as a part of their philosophy. And that, yeah, I mean, that they ended.
They have. It's called the Metroid series.
Okay, that's true. That's
like
true.
The Metroid series, they did actually make specific design decisions for speedrunners, because the Metroid series has always appealed to a more hardcore demographic than most of Nintendo's titles. But I think outside of that series, you're absolutely right. The Nintendo... I hate I don't want this to sound reductive, because I highly respect speedrunning. I think, you know, Games Done Quick is amazing and does really great work. But they are not a $1 trillion industry.
Yep.
Speedrunning is
true. Yeah. True.
Right. It's like, why should this multi-billion dollar company in Japan care about these things when it's niche? I think getting at.
Games Done Quick is counterculture that is created in reaction to how the games industry turned out. It's not the inevitable conclusion of where the games industry was going to go.
Yeah.
And so that plays into the statement here, how could Nintendo not have predicted speedrunning and GDQ in 1986? One is nobody could. I like that it's not the natural evolution of it, but it's something that we enjoy today. I do wish that today Nintendo would kind of embrace things like tournaments and embrace things like speedrunning and stuff like that. I think that would be wonderful. But I definitely don't think that anybody back in 1986 was like, oh, by the way, we need to release really hard games because 40 years later, there's going to be, you know, a speedrunning tournament that we should be a part of.
If they did, then there's another discussion to be had.
There. Right.
Because then someone has a crystal ball thing we have other things.
Yeah.
All right. Definitely. So I think, Joe, you're up next for the next question.
All right. Retro Monster said, it's not that it's too hard. Lots of NES games were too hard. It wasn't innovative enough compared to the total reinvention Nintendo's other flagship series, Zelda, was pushing for in its sequel. Mario needed to keep pace. That's a really interesting way of looking at it, to actually say that Mario needed to keep pace with Zelda, because we very often look at it sort of as Mario is the flagship and Zelda was the secondary. But that is interesting, because Zelda 2 was a significantly bigger departure from the original Legend of Zelda, and built under similar conditions, make a sequel to their game faster and get it out there for the people who have already completed the first one. So,
okay.
It's interesting.
Yeah. And Zelda 2, Castlevania 2, and Mario 2 USA are the ones that I love to refer to as the terrible three, the terrible trio. You know, the terrible twos, but they're not actually terrible, though.
No,
I think they're thought of as terrible. Like, I know a lot of people who hate Mario 2 USA because it's not a Mario game. You know, we talked about that.
I will not.
There's a lot of people who hate Zelda 2. There's a lot of people who hate Castlevania 2. I've played all three games and I like them.
Yep. Okay, just for clarification, I'm sorry. Castlevania 2 is Simon's Quest, right? I just want to make sure. I'm sorry. I know the basic.
No,
I just want to make sure I have that correct.
There's a lot of Castlevaniaism, all right? let's see. Bootman SRL included this one because this is a unique comment right here.
And that's you saying that, so I'm curious.
Yeah. Bootman SRL said Super Mario Brothers 2 Japan was in no way too hard for the North American audience. Instead, it represents the pinnacle of NES Famicom platforming greatness. I genuinely believe that even a casual player of that era, if given the chance, would have grown to love the game.
I genuinely disagree with that statement.
But this is the problem right here, where it's like, he has points. I know he must have some sort of specific framework. I don't have this person's specific context.
Right.
To know
what is the pinnacle of greatness?
What do you mean? Because that's the problem.
It's a fascinating comment, isn't it?
It is.
You don't get a comment like this all the time.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, please.
I'm going to take a stance in his favor, not because I specifically agree with this comment, because there's a whole lot about that comment that I can't agree with, but because as somebody who does actually really enjoy Super Mario Brothers 2 Japan, this is a great time to point out the difference between the lost levels and the original, which is that when he says the pinnacle of platforming greatness, while I disagree with that statement, I will say Super Mario Brothers 2 on the Famicom Disk System was pixel perfect in its platforming. It expected you, like the original Mario Brothers presented its levels more as sort of, here's just a play area that you were trying to get to the end of. Mario 2 was more like vignettes, almost puzzle-like. Here's a section. There's usually one good way to get through it, figure it out, and then execute on what you figured out. And sometimes those things are really obscure. But once you figure it out, you still have to do sometimes pixel-perfect platforming to make it through. And that's where the Super Nintendo version of the Lost Levels completely dropped the ball. It wasn't a emulation. It was a port. And it was a port that didn't perfectly match the physics of the originals, which is fine in Mario 1, Mario 2 USA, and Mario 3, because they were lenient, they were playful. And so the fact that the physics didn't perfectly match were okay. But when you take Mario 2, a pixel-perfect platformer, and screw with the physics, Now all of a sudden you get like the beginning of World 8-4, which is nearly impossible in the Lost Levels because it requires air control that the Super Nintendo version didn't have. And there's a number of points throughout the game like that that makes the Super Nintendo version by far the worst way to play. So I can agree when he says not the pinnacle of platforming greatness, but it was a finely tuned platformer. And the proof in just how finely tuned it was comes from playing the lesser tuned Super Nintendo port.
Okay. And I want to say that like that pixel perfection is really important, but it's a shame when it's in a game with blind jumps.
Yeah. That's kinda, what I mean. Yep. That's it.
It's one thing to have that finely tuned platforming and control. It's another thing when the game is kind of like a prank game, right?
I agree.
With Lost Levels, though, again, the primary frame of reference that we're going to have. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Bootman may be saying here, if given the chance to play the original NES Famicom game, that's one statement. But if given the chance to play the Lost Levels, there's no way that casual players will be guaranteed to fall in love with it. It's just it's not what happened historically when Lost Levels came out. And it's definitely not what happened anecdotally with myself. And yeah, I know a lot of people in the same circumstance as well.
And it's worth pointing out, casual players in 1986 didn't usually beat level one of Ghosts and Goblins. It was a different time.
Yeah,
right.
And people look back at that different time now, like we're like, we are core gamers who have gone back and played all these old games. Oh, it really wasn't all that hard. But in its original context, when it was originally released, we would rent it, play it, get our butts kicked, and then say, oh, that was fun. And then 20, 30 years down the road, we'd look back at it with rose-colored glasses and say, man, those were the good old days. I loved that game. Yeah. But casual players weren't into that crazy hard gaming. So, yeah, I struggle to imagine that even casual players would have grown to love Mario Brothers 2.
Yeah.
I agree.
Japan.
Here's a couple maybe answers.
I love this one. I'm up next. I'm about to say I'll do the next one. So the maybe answer. So Epps Jeffrey just said perfectly. So should have been released. No, but yes, but no. I don't know why I'm nodding my head.
I love that.
I'm like, also another 10 out of 10, but for completely opposite reasons. But another 10 out of 10.
Perfect summary of the last hour and a half of our conversation, really.
Pretty much. Yes. Right?
Yeah. So, Sarge Smash 1 says, was it too hard compared to other NES games? No. Was it too hard for a Smash hit that needed to appeal to more than the hardcore? Yes. Not to mention expectations were rising for what a sequel would look like. A hard mode level pack probably wouldn't have been well received.
Specifically in North America. Again.
In North America, within that context. Yeah, no.
I'm not a big fan of reducing Super Mario Bros. 2 Japan into just calling it an expansion pack or a level pack, because it was what sequels often looked like in that era.
Yeah.
They didn't see it as they were building an expansion pack. They were building a sequel. They were just building a specific type of sequel that we now know it doesn't work very well.
Right. And the world, you could say that now, though, because the world's smaller, right? Yeah. This is very much, again, the North American perspective, which from our perspective is very much a hard mode level pack. I've called it an expansion pass, but I don't have that specific regional context from the 80s with Japanese games to kind of frame that.
Right.
And that's not my fault. Because they didn't send the games over here. Exactly. Carnival, too hard, probably. It's not just a user-friendly game, and it's not very well put together. It feels more like the type of episodic sequel you'd see from shareware games on PC in the early 90s. Next one. Different enough. Answers about not different enough.
Okay, so that's from Herb Kaiser 1. And this is, yes, but the main reason I think they never published it is that it is not different enough not different enough. At the time, NES sequels tried new things, and Super Mario Brothers 2 - Lost Levels is more like a level pack instead with added difficulty. Again, I knew that there was going to be more of a framework of like, this just feels like either an expansion pack or a level pack, which I mean, I know we dissected this a lot, so I won't delve too much into it, but that's the perception of it.
The question, should it have come out over here? Our perspective over here is level pack perspective.
Yeah.
So
it's our perspective is, should we have got it or Doki Doki Panic?
Exactly.
Right. And like, feels like the answer to that question is fairly obvious from a games business.
Can I just have like a quick thing? Just will take 2 seconds with my own intro, like my thing with Doki Doki Panic. So there's a local video game store near me where I get a lot of my retro stuff from. They have a little bit of a demo display. It'll take 2 seconds. They have a little display counter where they do randomized consoles and games that you can try out when you're paying for things at the register. And for 3 days, they did Doki Doki Panic on the original Famicom, and I wasn't able to get to the store. And it's one of the things I'm so upset about, because I really wanted to play Doki Doki Panic like on the original hardware. That's it. That's all I had to say. There's nothing relevant in the comment. I just figured to put my 2 cents in there somewhere. There I'm go. So heartbroken about it.
That would have been fun. Hopefully someday you'll get your wish.
I know. That's what I'm hoping for.
And let's see. Joe's up next. Here you go.
Retro Gaming Dev said, I think Nintendo made the right choice in giving us an alternative. Super Mario Brothers 2, The Lost Levels, has always felt like Super Mario Brothers 1.5 to me. Mario 2 really set the stage that each game was going to be something special, plus lots of stuff introduced that may never have been.
The one plus sum, right?
Exactly.
1.5. Julian Titus, I only played it all the way through once back on the All-Stars cart and don't remember having problems getting through it. Julian Titus is stronger than many of us. He said, but I thought it was boring! And just felt like a level pack. There it is again, of Super Mario Brothers 1. Reskinning DD Panic was the better call. I also think Lost Levels is kind of boring. Like, it's weird because there's constantly crazy stuff happening, but it's also really dull.
Yeah, but can I just say, I think Lost Levels is boring, period. All of them. I think the way they skinned all of the games in Lost Levels was not a very good aesthetic on the Super Nintendo. But that's my
two cents. All Stars?
I'm talking about All Stars. I'm talking about the context in which Lost Levels was played in this scenario, which was through the All Stars pack.
Yeah. What were you going to say, Joe?
Lost Levels, I can understand why somebody might say it was boring, because it's considerably less dynamic than Super Mario Brothers 1, which is funny to say, because this is a game that's constantly throwing you into pits and, causing you to blind jumps. But that pattern that I talked about earlier, where it's more like puzzle vignettes, where I get to a section of the level and I have to figure out how to get through it, means that it's a Mario game in which I'm constantly stopping and thinking about what I need to do next, which feels quite different on your first playthrough than Super Mario Brothers 1. And I think that goes back to where I'm talking about how it trains you in order to 100% that game. It trains you to be a speedrunner. Is effectively, you have to go through the process of stopping, learning, trying, dying, trying, succeeding over and over and over again to get to the end of the first time. And the second time you're better. And then the third time you're even better. But the first time through that game, absolutely, it has a different flow that I could see how somebody would call that boring.
Joe, how do you have perfect answers to everything? You've been doing this like for the past 2 episodes, and I'm like, I feel so like I don't even know how to supplement anything. I just, everything's a perfect response from you. Okay.
I mean, I'm not going to be egotistical enough to agree with that statement, but thank you. But I'm a game designer by trade, entire career is studying video games and how they're put together. So
yeah, no, I'm going to be delving more into your brain later in the future. Just be prepared for that because you've been answering a lot of questions. We'll dive
into the bottom on Joe here. I think it's where just a short piggyback on it. One thing that I run into a lot with Mario discussion is people will say, "Well, Mario's everyone. Mario's the everyman. Mario's basic. He's generic." And I don't tend to agree with that, because I think that if you were to know somebody as energetic, selfless, cheerful, joyful, fun, all of that as Super Mario, they would be one of the most unique and interesting people that you could possibly know. Like, people are just not that cheerful. A lot of people, especially in our time now, are cynical and frankly dull. But Mario, though, what is Mario about? I think he's really about momentum. What Joe said, like, it's kind of counter to what Mario games are about to have. And I mentioned mainline Mario games. Obviously, there's a lot of different Mario games. There's puzzle Mario games, of course. But to have a mainline kind of platformer Mario game where you have to stop and do all these really technical things really just does not fall in line with what we've come to understand Mario as being about. And I really think it is about momentum, about moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. It's specifically in the context of platforming at this time.
Yes.
Like, 'cause you're right, there are different iterations that I think develop a different mindset and mood for the character, but within the context, and we're talking about it strictly as a side-scrolling platformer in this era.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's sneak a little bit of Mario 2 USA in here at the end. Mario 2 USA kind of deserves its own episode. We've been spending a lot of time talking about, you know, Mario 2 Japan and Lost Levels. Those are games, and Mario 2 USA is its own thing in a lot of ways too. But a big thing about that is its ensemble cast. Now, we did run a poll and got a bunch of results here for favorite playable character in Mario 2. And they were in the order here. Mario got 15.5% of the votes for favorite character. Toad got 19.1% of the votes for favorite character. Luigi, 27.5% of the votes. And Peach at a whopping...
Which makes sense.
Yes, 37.8% of the votes. Now, you said, does this make sense? What do you think about the way that these four kind of results came in here? Is this something that you would expect?
I think that this chart right here explains in a nutshell why Nintendo brought Doki Doki Panic to the West instead of Super Mario Bros. 2 Japan, because Peach is easy mode.
Yeah.
Luigi can jump higher and skip portions of the levels and is generally a bit easier than the others. Mario and Toad are very close to each other on this poll, and also are pretty close to each other as far as, you know, Toad can move faster, Mario can jump a little bit higher, but both of them are, you know, fairly similar in play style. And what this poll tells me is that the West, America in particular, was more interested in an easier game.
Yeah.
That's a great extrapolation.
That's a good way to explain it. It's true.
The surprise that I had is that Toad is not higher. And that's maybe because Toad players are very vocal.
Well, also, I think Luigi's more recognizable even at the time, which Mario 2 USA. Because, you know, you had the backlog with Luigi in the earlier parts of the series.
Right. No, that's for sure. I just think, like, I've met a lot of people who are like, you know, Toad or GTFO. But it's very much that kind of the people who are rightfully proud of their gaming skills and vocal about it. So I'm surprised it's not higher. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, Toad is arguably hard mode. Toad is also my favorite to play as. And I think you're right. I think those of us who like to main Toad are proud of the fact that we're maining hard mode.
Yeah.
I love that we can kind of break these four characters down into personality types. We really can. Yeah. Crit, who's your favorite of the four?
Listen, I was a ride or die Luigi. And that was actually because again, I was born in the early 90s, so I did not get to play this when it first came out. And Luigi was just naturally my favorite character in the Mario series when being introduced to other elements of just the entire universe of it. I mean, and the big reason why was Super Mario 64 was my first 3D Mario game, which came out when I was very young and pretty much my introduction to 3D games in general. And at that time, which I'm sure people remember, was the whole idea that Luigi a playable character in Mario 64? Is it something that would be possible? So the first time that I played Mario 2, because my father had a copy of the game back when, before I was born, was the idea when I put it in for the first time at a very, very young age, I think it was like 5 or 6, Luigi was there. And I was like, oh, there's Luigi. I always want to play Luigi. So I just clicked that character and I did a playthrough of it just as Luigi exclusively, because it filled that desire that I had to play this character that wasn't accessible in my first Mario game, essentially. So it's very like specifically oriented for that reason.
Interesting. Yeah, and I think Luigi has a lot of fans too, because Luigi, he represents an underdog narrative.
Exactly. I agree.
And he's also, you know, if you were a kid brother or kid sister, you were Luigi.
Yeah, I'm the, like, oh no, I'm the youngest sibling. I was a younger brother.
There
I
it is. More to Luigi, yeah, right there, there it is.
I think Luigi's a
see,
great.
See, I was sibling. The eldest, so yeah, for me, I was right more there. Into Mario, but yeah. I didn't find Mario interesting. Mm-hmm. I thought it was cool that you could fly as Peach.
Yeah, that float, was the coolest rather. Element, especially in a platforming at the time. That just seemed like a really cool concept.
Yeah, and now that I've kind of arrived at a lot of different kind of opinions that are set in stone, I'm very much like, hey, games are for everyone. I love that. So Peach is my favorite character for this. I actually jump between Toad and Peach, because sometimes I'm like, Peach, could you speed it up just a skosh? You're so slow. But then you jump over to Toad and you fall in a pit, and then you're like, all right, back to Peach. We have a couple of questions here that are quasi related about the roster. So let me just breeze through these real quick. Aros Elric, looking back on the legacy of Mario 2, do you feel as if it was the catalyst for the Mario Bros. Franchise containing an ensemble cast? And what are your thoughts on an Americanized Toad being a supporting character in a Mario cartoon? Treaky Boy said, do you think Doki Doki Panic shaped subsequent Mario games? Before Super Mario Bros. 2, the Mario games were pretty linear. But Mario Bros. 2 introduced verticality, more diverse levels, and weird yet iconic enemies like Shy Guys, Bomb-Oms, and Birdo that we see today. And Duo Beard, if we didn't get Doki Doki Panic, how drastic would the current roster be in terms of overall gameplay? And I feel like these three questions represent the perfect kind of capstone to this.
Yes.
Where we've talked about, you know, what we did get, what we didn't get, but what we did get changed Mario canon fundamentally forever.
Yeah. It's the ensemble. It's the ensemble element. It's what it did with the design elements to a series that then would be later influenced in future iterations of it. I don't know. Like, even just thinking about Super Mario RPG, it's hard to even imagine that idea of like doing a cast, even in an RPG formula, without having Mario 2, the USA version. I mean, I'm so biased. I love this game so much. I really do. From an aesthetic standpoint, a music standpoint. And I think a lot of the comments here, specifically about the idea of the diverse levels. I mean, yeah, I just have to say this real quick. Even the first level of Mario 2 USA version, where you literally just fall down without knowing Doki Doki Panic, just that being your introduction, which it was for me, I adored it. I think it just drastically changed my entire perception of platforming when I originally played the first Super Mario Brothers before playing Super Mario Brothers 2. And it just introduced a different element of it that I just thought was vital at the time.
Yeah, that totally makes sense to me. Joe, what do you know?
Yeah, so I think the what's interesting is all of these sort of kind of focus on that Doki Doki Panic, Doki Doki Panic characters, or at least the enemies, ended up getting brought into the Mario canon. And that if you look at the Mario canon before then, like, we don't think of it as being an ensemble cast, but I would argue that Miyamoto, he is an ensemble type game designer. And we saw glimpses of it all the way back at the beginning. Donkey Kong comes out and there are three characters on screen, which is something that actually was unusual at that time. Usually you've got a bunch of clones of the same enemy and then the player character, like Galaxian / Space Invaders type stuff.
Yeah.
Or you had a couple of different enemy types and your character, but there were three very distinctive characters, Mario, Pauline, and Donkey Kong. Then when you get into Mario Brothers, the enemies themselves start getting personalities complete with their own names, sidesteppers and shell creepers and all of that. Super Mario Brothers, I remember back in 1986, 87, sitting down with the manual and kind of reading and memorizing the names of all of the different enemies that were inside the game. And I watch my 7-year-old now do the same thing in my 30 something years of Mario anniversary hardback book, where he's going through this massive ensemble cast. I think that's always been Miyamoto's style, which means I think that Super Mario Brothers 2 Japan was the odd one out for not introducing even more characters into the canon. And I think Doki Doki Panic was more in line with Miyamoto's vision of what Mario should be. It's all theoretical, but it appears that way.
Yeah, that
a couple perfectly. Things on that. I think that I had heard that Mario 2 Japan added a different kind of like movement style for Luigi.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. So you were already starting to get the slippery, slidey, jumper, high-y type Luigi in Mario 2 Japan, huh?
Yep. But what's funny is that it also is a game that is very much tuned for playing as Mario. So while there are some of the most difficult sections in the game are slightly easier with Luigi, the average section of the game is easier with Mario.
Interesting. Interesting. I feel like this comment is made about the cast with Mario 2, specifically for the range of playable characters. There's absolutely no argument, you know, what you just said about all the number of bad guys and enemies, and you know, you've got Bowser and Toad and stuff like that, and they're there. Donkey Kong, Pauline, and all that stuff, they're there. Mario 2 giving you the option to play not just between Mario and Green Mario, if you're old enough to remember when people called Luigi Green Mario. I remember that. Even it said Luigi on the screen, didn't it? And did it say Luigi on the screen in Mario Brothers 1?
I believe so. I believe it would say Mario X, you know, 3 if you had 3 lives at the beginning of the game.
Right. Or it would say a Luigi. Okay.
Yeah.
See, I remember kids saying Green Mario. It must have been back before we could read. We're just like, we knew who Mario was. We didn't know who. Luai guy? What the? But yeah. And then, so I think that that's part of why people think of Mario 2 is having that ensemble with the playable characters, which is really fun. I don't particularly enjoy the new Super Mario Bros. Games. One, I think the title is, well, now it's like incorrect, like flat out, because there's not really new anymore. But I like that you can have those multiple different playable characters again.
Yeah.
Super Mario 3D World, a much more appropriate title. An excellent game, and it's wonderful that you've got these characters back again. So I love that kind of became a format here that they could return to. Also do love Shy Guys. Maybe my favorite Mario enemy, as far as basic enemies go, are Shy Guys. Sniffits were in this game. Those faces that would chase you around when you pick up a key. Name something more anxiety inducing as a child than the face chasing you.
The angry sun.
The angry sun.
God, angry sun is huge.
The angry sun. It's the same energy. You had like the angry face that chases you around.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, final question here from Bakuiel, Doki Doki Mage Cast X. I love this game. First NES game I beat before my brother. Question, why do you think they've taken so many enemies from this game into modern games, yet we've never seen Wart? So we did mention Wart makes a cameo appearance in some Zelda games, right?
Yes.
I want to say he makes an appearance in the Super Mario Bros. Super Show cartoon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He does? So. Okay.
Yeah.
I believe so.
I have not watched all of those episodes, certainly not a long time, but it would be cool to have Wart back for like a mainline Mario game again.
I think Wart's a good character, but I don't think it's a character that needs to be incorporated like the other the things that were the enemies and designs that were brought in from Mario 2, I think were all the right ones in the long run. Mm-hmm. Wart, I think, would be an interesting take, like, or a very interesting element. Like, they could do something very interesting with it, but now that I really think about it, like, is Wart also the most iconic image when we think of Mario games? I don't know.
Not really, yeah.
Not really.
And that may be because he's not used so much. But if they do use him again, they need to keep him associated with Dreams, I think.
Yeah, I agree. That's true.
Well, that's actually what I was about to get at, is that I feel like, you know, Wart might not be the most iconic, but Mario's never returned to the land of Subcon, which is kind of the iconic part of Super Mario Brothers 2, is it's this dream land. And I, you know, the first time I saw the trailer again for Super Mario Brothers Wonder, I couldn't help but kind of think, wouldn't it be interesting if this was a return to Subcon? I don't think it is, but it would have been interesting if they'd have gone that direction with it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, that is when I would feel like we should see Wart come back, is as the king of Subcon and do another Dream World Mario game. That'd be great. Yes.
Yeah. Watch it happen and wonder now, because they're playing around with all that weirdness, you know?
True.
He wakes up and then, it was just a dream. I want to leave you listeners with this. There is a villager in Animal Crossing named Wart Jr. Is it the son of Wart? The world may never know. But my friends, thanks for listening to this episode of MageCast X. It's been a pleasure to discuss these games. Well, four games today we covered in one episode. You did pretty good, I think, gentlemen.
Yeah, no, I really love this.
Yeah, Crit, thanks for being here.
Absolutely, as always. You. And thank you, Joe. I mean, the insight you brought to the past two episodes, like, I really... There's just more that I want to know about now. So thank you for taking the time, Joe.
Well, you know what? Well, there's going to be a book coming out.
There will be a book, and I will be getting that
And
book.
You can learn more. So, Joe, give us a little taste of where the listeners can find you. If they want to learn more, where can we find you?
Absolutely. So you can find me on social media, Twitter and Facebook at SyncoPlay, SyncoPlay. Instagram and Threads at Single Play Games. Although you'll probably get a hold of me at Twitter a lot faster than you will on Instagram at this point. I've got my book currently out with a sample, 32-page sample at beyondthenes.com. The whole thing is just a love letter to the Famicom games we never received in the West.
Yeah.
Designed just to feel like you are going through old gaming magazines, but finding games that our magazines never actually discussed. So yeah, come check it out at beyondthenes.com and feel free to reach out to me on Twitter if you want to chat old nerdy stuff.
Yes. Perfect. Or trains. and I want to add too, with the book, there's a utility there as well, that should be mentioned. It is a love letter to these games, and like, that may not matter to you because you maybe are not familiar with these games, but if you want to be familiar with these games, I think the lovely utility of Joe's book is that he tells you which games Japanese knowledge is required for, as far as the knowledge of the language, the fluency in the language, and degrees of that. I think that if there's not like a sales pitch for this book, that's it right there. Like, the moment I saw that, I was like, boom, I'm sold. That's it.
Yeah, there's hundreds of games that were released only in Japan that are either in full English, or the amount of Japanese text in those games is so minimal that you can safely ignore it. And so, a huge chunk of the book is sort of sifting through all of the, you know, hundreds of adventure games and RPGs that require all of your Japanese reading skills to find the ones that a Westerner can both play and enjoy. We don't shy away in the book from also highlighting games that are worth playing that might require a translation patch or a bit of a walkthrough. But in the cases in which I can put in a walkthrough, I often do to help you get past the language barrier without having to resort to emulation and language patches, so that you can play it on original hardware in original context if you want. So, yeah.
Awesome. Okay. Huh? So now you can play Strip Sudoku. Because you know how, so yeah, there's a lot of adult games that didn't come out of Japan as well.
That was Famicom Disk System, but yes, Hacker International had quite the library of stuff that probably won't end up in the book.
Because then it would have to be sealed on bookstore shelves. Well, again, thank you, gentlemen. That Crit, thanks for being here. Joe, thank you for sharing.
And thank
your
you, Mage, as always. Another great episode. I love this.
Thank you for having me.
I will see you all next time. Take care of yourselves. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for listening to MageCast X. If you enjoyed the conversation, here's what you can do next. Browse our library and check out another episode. You could also leave a review or rating on your app of choice, such as Apple or Spotify. You could go the extra mile and support us on patreon.com/thepixels. Finally, you could join our Discord community and find us at our social accounts in the podcast description. This episode may be over, but the legend will live on, passed down by the dwarves, the elves, and the dragons.